is online for people?
I do not know.
To John or anything? I don't know if he did or not.
I do not know. Like I say, I was writing that out. I told you all last week that I would I'd print out the timeline.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did. There it is. It's beautiful. I just need a chance to do it. My power went out. I need a chance to make copies.
Make copies.
So, you have a copier? Oh, man. Alrighty.
So, I have, do you want to make a copy of the hour?
Sure.
Okay.
You guys want a copy? You know,
yeah,
follow.
I didn't
get finished with all my notes on it, but I got a copy made.
You were getting
a doctor. You got to figure that out first thing in the morning. Well, I didn't go to work today, so I didn't.
Oh, you didn't?
No.
What time do you usually come home, like, when you're out of town on Fridays?
Usually right before this. Probably about... Well, I've been going to physical therapy for my knee, and I'll come in a little early.
Okay.
But today, I'm released. I'm healed.
All right.
Wow.
No more physical therapy. Great.
Yeah.
You just walk around and play basketball anytime you want?
Yeah. He said it, you know, a lot of, like my knee kind of stays swole up a little bit. He said that usually takes a few more months. But the doctor, orthopedic surgeon looked at it today. He says, is this something he would work on? He was amazed. He was, you know, doing what they do. And he says, man, that thing healed up perfect. You know, so we'll see if we can tear the other one up now. I'm going to go get my toe worked on. I've got a joint in my toe that I, probably when the kids were little, we were at a swimming pool and I went running and there was uneven cement and I hit that thing and stumped it and it's always bothered me. And now I'm going to go to the doctor to check you out, so I might be hobbling around again.
When I was...
I don't have to go. If I wait till next year, then I have to pay another deductible.
That's right.
This is true. When I was 18 or 19, I was playing out at Jimmy Becker's house. We were playing football, and they had a fire pit over there, a bunch of rocks around where they had a fire. And I ran and caught the football, or missed it, I don't remember. I'm not trying to brag about catching it. It was just, I tripped and hit one of my knees, hit one of those rocks. And it was such pain. It hurt me so bad, they couldn't believe it. They couldn't believe I wasn't faking it. It was really a bad pain, and it just took a long time to go away. And that was fine, you know, finally went away and everything. But within, I guess it was 6 months, I had gotten married. We'd gone down to Mexico. Might have been 6, 7 months after that. The front of my foot stopped working. This muscle right here just quit working so that I could not lift my foot like this right here.
Oh, my God.
I couldn't lift my foot. And I first noticed it because I'm walking and my foot would slap. It would just, you're walking and your foot just slaps on the ground. Okay, that's weird. And then I noticed I couldn't lift it.
Oh, my goodness.
And so I went to the doctor, you know, looked it up. And, of course, I was dealing with a hack doctor down there anyway. He says, that's called foot drop. He says, we're gonna have to get a test made to find out what it is. So he sent me, it cost me $50. Back then, that was like, you know, my entire, everything. It was a lot of money to me at that time. Anyway, I went to this test. They put me and strapped me into this thing and had this prod with two things.
Oh, God.
And they did it not just to the one leg, but to both legs. They sit there and bam! I'm telling you, it was an hour. It was like torture.
The cow prod.
They hand me the papers. I go back to this doctor and he says, well, that was negative. We're gonna have to check for multiple. He said that was to test for muscular dystrophy. He said now we're gonna check for multiple sclerosis. He said now what we gotta do is take a long needle. I can do it. I know what I'm doing. We're gonna stick it in your spine. People have headaches for the rest of their life after that. I just want you to know. And I said, you know, I really don't mind foot drop. I like it. It's fine. I just walked away and I never went back about it. About 6 months later, it healed itself. It started getting strength and now it's okay.
You must have had something pinched in there, huh?
I don't know what it was.
I don't even care. I realized right then the test is way worse than the problem. It's not worth it to me. All right. Now, I don't know if I read to you guys the Edict of Milan last time. It's truly an amazing document. This is the one that gave religious liberty to Christians. Perceiving long ago that religious liberty ought not to be denied, but that it ought to be granted to the judgment and desire of each individual to perform his religious duties according to his own choice. Remember, this is the Roman Empire writing this. It's not on y'all's paper. I didn't get her. You can make copies if you want, but I didn't think you wanted copies of this. Anyway, this is just an amazing document for being written back in the year 313. Anyway, but perform his religious duties according to his own choice. We had given orders that every man, Christians as well as others, should preserve the faith of his own sect and religion. But since in this rescript in which much liberty was granted them, many and various conditions seemed clearly added. Some of them, it may be, after a little while, retired from such observance. When I, Constantine Augustus, and I, Licinia Augusta, came under favorable auspices to Milan and took under consideration everything which pertained to the common weal and prosperity, we resolved, among other things, or rather, first of all, to make such decrees as seemed in many respects to benefit everyone, such as should preserve reverence and piety toward the deity. We resolved, that is, to grant both to the Christians and to all men freedom to follow the religion which they choose, that whatever heavenly divinity exists may be propitious to us and to all that live under our government. We have therefore determined, with sound and upright purpose, that liberty is to be denied to no one, to choose and to follow the religious observance of the Christians, but that to each one freedom is to be given to devote his mind to that religion which he may think adapted to himself, in order that the deity may exhibit to us in all things his accustomed care and favor. It was fitting that we should write that this is our pleasure, that those conditions being entirely left out which were contained in our former letter concerning the Christians which was sent to your devotedness. Everything that seemed very severe and foreign to our mildness may be annulled, and that now everyone who has the same desire to observe the religion of the Christians may do so without molestation. We have resolved to communicate this most fully to thy care, in order that thou mayest know that we have granted to these same Christians freedom and full liberty to observe their own religion. Since this has been granted freely to them, thy devotedness perceives that liberty is granted to others also who may wish to follow their own religious observances, it being clearly in accordance with the tranquility of our times, that each one should have the liberty of choosing and worshiping whatever deity he chooses. This has been done by us in order that we might not seem in any way to discriminate against any rank of religion. And it goes on. But just think about that. This was revoked in the year 380 when Theodosius, the emperor, declared Christianity to be the official religion of Rome and all the Roman Empire. And so this, all of a sudden, just gets thrown away. But this was written back in the year 313, lasted about 60, 70 years. Absolute freedom of religion in the Roman Empire. Choose any deity, religion, however you please. We're not going to bother you at all. And of course, this didn't come back into play until Rhode Island, I guess. Until probably 1680 or something like that, when Rhode Island declared religious liberty according to the Baptist principles back in those days. Anyway, it's an amazing document. It's an amazing fact that somehow these two emperors just caught the idea that just who cares who they worship? Hopefully, you know, whoever they're worshiping will be good to us, you know, that sort of thing. Anyway, I gave you a timeline of significant events in Christian history, and this timeline is of what I consider significant events. If you look at a regular timeline of Christianity, you'll find all kinds of events that I don't think are bad at all. They're usually councils and what have you. And of course, I did not put in the Council of Nicaea, the Nicene Council or the Nice Council, which also is pretty important because that ended the wars or the disputes over the Trinity in the West. So you can look at this timeline. You can see what I consider important. I think I did go over this last week, so I'm not going to go over it again terribly. The fact that the fall of Rome in 470, I don't know if you noticed several things that are amazing here. You've got the fall of Rome and the resurgence of Muhammad and Muhammadism. Interesting one is the Synod of Whitby, that the English Rite submits to the Romish Rite. And the reason why this is important in my mind is because the English Rite, or what they call the Celtic Rite, which is a type of Christianity that was separate from Romish Christianity, up until the year 664, St. Patrick was with the Celtic Rite, and Columba and Columbanus and all of these missionaries to the Scots and to the Irish, they were not Romish. These were not Catholics, not Roman Catholics. They were Catholics after a fashion, but they had a whole different idea. They celebrated different days and different. They had their different ways of thinking. And the reason why they say that is because a lot of the English reformers studied Wycliffe, and Wycliffe was the light that came out of all this, out of the Dark Ages. It was Wycliffe, and they think that Wycliffe had gotten a hold of the Celtic Rite, and that there were Celtic Rite churches still in Britain throughout that entire time. In fact, that was one of the arguments of the Scottish Church, John Knox, and all of them, that the true faith of the Protestants was according to the Celtic Rite, and that had been transmitted in England all along, and finally came to light in Wycliffe's time. And it is true, it's amazing how Wycliffe came up with all this stuff. Wycliffe was an amazing character, and we'll probably get to him later, but I got a list of the stuff that he was, his special teachings, and if you'll see it, you'll realize there's something about Wycliffe. Let's see if I can find it. Yes, Wycliffe. He was anti-papacy. He did not believe in sending any money to Rome. He would just preach that we should keep money that we collect in the churches should stay here in England. Shouldn't go to Rome. And of course, that's been a big complaint against Rome since forever, even among Catholics. Yeah. He was anti-Rome. He believed that bishop and presbyter were the same office, which is purely biblical. That's just, it's like he understood. And that's the way all the early Christians, including Ignatius and Clement, and all, they all spoke of presbyter and bishop as the same exact office. Elder means presbyter, elder. Presbyter turned into a priest, which is a different office altogether according to the Old Testament. But all of these things were early on considered the same exact office. They changed when they became hierarchical, where you had the bishop was higher than a priest or the presbyter, that's the elder. So an elder was under a bishop, and a bishop had people over him, including archbishop and cardinal, and they had other names for him and stuff. Anyway, Wycliffe, he taught that, it's just like it says in the Bible, they were the same office. He was anti-celibacy. He rejected celibacy. It's not required that elders or priests or bishops be celibate. He insisted that infant baptism was unnecessary. You did not have to baptize your babies, although he did baptize babies. But he did teach that it wasn't necessary. It wasn't biblical. He did not believe that baptism saved you. He did not believe that by baptizing a baby, it would save that baby's soul. He did not believe in transubstantiation. He did not believe that what they call the real presence, he did not believe that the Eucharist turned into the body of Christ, which is huge back in the Middle Ages. This is such, where you come up with that? You know, he was against oaths, which is a lot like the Waldensians and the other Anabaptist groups. And he believed in liberty of conscience, much like this Edict of Milan. He believed that everybody believes what they want.
What oath?
Swearing. You can't take any oath.
What would you take an oath to?
Like swearing on the Bible in court. Oh. They're not allowed to do that. Just like Quakers can't, and just like Jehovah's Witnesses can't to this day. And I won't. I won't take an oath on the Bible. Like Jesus said, I'll tell the truth. If they say, do you swear? Blah, 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 blah. I'll tell the truth. You know. The idea is if you tell the truth all the time, you don't need to swear. And the only reason why you swear is because you're admitting you're a liar. And so you have to swear so that they'll believe that you're telling the truth now. Which is Jesus' argument. He says, let your yea be yea and your nay be nay. If you just say yes when you mean yes and say no when you mean no, you don't have to swear. You never have to make an oath. But it doesn't really matter, because usually they say, do you swear or affirm or whatever, that you, what you can tell is the truth? And if you say, well, yes, what I'm going to tell is the truth. But even in court, all you got to do is say, I won't swear, but what I'm going to say is the truth. And they'll accept that. You are then under oath, even though you didn't take an oath. Anyway, I thought that was... This English rite idea, that's the idea. You know that St. Patrick was made a saint by the Catholic Church long afterwards, and he was not even a member of the Roman Catholic rite. It was a separate thing. And if you'll realize, in fact, I've got probably 5 or 6 books at the house that I ordered years ago, just because I was interested in the subject, on the Irish Church. The Irish Church was separate. Even after the Synod of Whitby, they were separate, and they were sending missionaries to Europe during the Dark Ages. Hundreds of missionaries were going, and they had a center of teaching. They had teachers there in Ireland that were very strong, evangelical, Bible-believing type groups. They were not papacy. They were not Romish. They they had a strong system of colleges, universities that they were teaching all these things. And they were the Enlightenment. They were the enlightened nation back in the Dark Ages. When the fall of Rome happened, Rome fell, and what happened was there was no central power. When Rome fell as an empire, the Germanic tribes up north got independent. They sacked Rome several times. And then you had the eastern tribes. And then, of course, the ones over here on the western side. All of them, it just became chaos. And that became a whole bunch of feudal kingdoms all over Europe. It was really chaos. And that's when the Mohammedans started attacking them. And the Muslims started moving in. And the one safe place was Ireland. They could get to England fairly easily, but then Ireland was like a bastion of Christianity for 1,000 years. And it's very well documented. It's an interesting history. In fact, they have so many medieval manuscripts that came out of Ireland. And you can tell they're from Ireland because the Irish had a special way of what they call illustrations. They had a special way of writing with... Like they would start their manuscripts, they would start them with gold letters, and it would be flourishing. They're just beautiful. They're worth lots of money right now, any Irish manuscripts, and because they had such a flourish to them, they were very fancy. They became very good at copying. Anyway, a lot of people don't realize this. You never read about this in the Christian histories or whatever, but that Ireland was a bastion of Christianity when Europe was overrun by Attila and Hannibal and the Goths and the Germanic tribes up north. And the Synod of Whitby happened right after the Rome fell. When Rome fell, the papacy took on its power. There was already beginnings of the papacy before Rome fell, but once Rome fell, it fell upon the Pope to try to keep order. And that's what they call the Holy Roman Empire now. They kept on trying to rebuild the Roman Empire, but through the Pope, and that's called the Holy Roman Empire. If you'll read in the prophecies, like in Daniel, where it talks about, you remember the statue that they made, or that the Nebuchadnezzar dreamed about, and the head was gold, and the shoulders were silver, and the body was brass, and then the legs were steel, and the loins were steel, and as it went down, or iron, or whatever it was, probably not steel, but it's iron. they didn't invent steel until in the 17th century or something like that. Anyway, they were iron, and then he tells you very clearly, the head of gold is Babylon, then the silver is the Persians, and then comes Greece, which was Javan, or it says Greece in the Bible, calls it Greece, and that's Alexander and Philip of Macedon. They completely conquered the world. And after Greece, it doesn't mention their name, who they are, but we know who conquered Greece, and that was Rome. And Rome was the empire of iron. But then Rome divided into two legs. But it even says in there that it changes from iron to iron mixed with clay. And of course, that's where we get that the iron lost its strength, but that it's still there. It was just the iron mixed with clay. And that's the idea of the Holy Roman Empire. So this European Empire, that's the old Roman Empire, which would include all of those nations and countries and cultures that came out of that Roman Empire at that time, still exist. They exist in what we call Western nations. It's the Europe. Europe is the ancient Roman Empire, but it's in a different form. It's the iron mixed with clay. And it would even extend all the way to America and even into the New World. Because that's all, we're all part of the Roman hegemony. It's the Roman culture. We use Roman characters. Our alphabets are Roman. It's everything. Our way of, our laws are Roman. So, anyway, when the fall of Rome happened, the papacy took power, and then this papacy, this bishop of Rome, started trying to consolidate his allies, his power, and he did that, and he finally convinced the English church, not the Irish church, but the English church, which followed the Celtic rite, he finally convinced them to join him in 664. That was called the Synod of Whitby. And before that, of course, they were sending out missionaries all over. And St. Patrick was one of those missionaries, went over to Ireland and won nearly all of Ireland. He was an amazing person, although they have very little direct information about him. Of course, I mentioned the Battle of Tours and the Battle of Acroinon. Those actually stemmed the advance of the Muslims into Europe, and that was because some of these kings decided to fight, and apparently God helped them. One thing I've noticed, though, when I look at this history, is how you can see how God did something, how God steps in and does something. Like, for example, look at 1450, fall of Constantinople to the Turks. Jerusalem fell like in 1100, somewhere around then. Jerusalem fell to the Turks, and so the Crusades were a lost cause. They tried to save them for a long time, but they lost them. And then they divided after that. They divided, or right before that, the East and the West became completely separate churches. They just couldn't get along, I guess. It's a part of the course for big churches. They don't get along. But anyway, they divided. It's called the Great Schism. Anyway, if you'll notice that after a while, and this is what happened in those days, because the Muslims got more powerful and more powerful as they were going. They had universities and centers of learning, and all these, the Muslims were very strong. They advanced back up into Spain, had taken over all of Spain, called the Moors, the Moorish occupation. And then they started attacking over here on the other side, what's now Turkey. And they finally overtook Constantinople in the year 1450. But why don't you look at that? 1450, what was the next one? 1453. The printing press got invented. Now, why is this significant? All of those Greek scribes, and before the printing press, all Bibles were written by hand. And so all those Greek scribes had all of those manuscripts of the Greek Vulgate, and they were forced to leave the East. They had to come into the West. And they moved to the West, and they had all of these valuable manuscripts. So the West, as soon as they get a printing press, they are flooded with Greek manuscripts. It caused a tremendous interest in the West for the Greek Bible. And so they began printing Bibles. And the first Bible, of course, was the Latin Vulgate that was printed on the first printing press. The first run was the Latin Vulgate printed. But everybody was clamoring for an update of the Vulgate according to the Greek Bible. They wanted the Bibles to be merged. They wanted not to have two different Bibles. And there was a difference. The difference between these Vulgates was there were some differences. And they saw the differences, and they wanted a Bible that merged both of these Bibles. And that's what we have now. It's called the Textus Receptus. That's a principle. I'll deal with it in a little bit about why it's important. But that's just not a coincidence. The fact that Constantinople falls in 1450, and in 1453, the printing press is invented. That's a strange coincidence. Then look at 1492. Amazing, amazing, where God had raised up a guy like Wycliffe and it caused a tremendous resurgence of Bible knowledge and Bible doctrine. And this was a strong current back in those days. You know, they talk about the Reformation happening by Martin Luther or whatever. It was already happening. It had been happening for hundreds of years. Wycliffe was a big star in it, and people were following his doctrines. He followed John Huss over there in Bavaria, was also following it. It was a huge movement, especially in the Atlantic States, in Holland and in England and in Scotland. This was a huge movement. And it was clamoring not first to divide the church, or they were clamoring for reformation. They wanted the church to be reformed. They wanted the Pope to say, we're going to kick out these priests that are, you know, not doing right, and we're going to go back to Bible doctrine. That was their whole motivation. But in 1492, the New World was discovered. That's the Americas. Now, why is that important? It's important because then all of a sudden, all of the old powers were Italy. And the Eastern powers, Italy and Hungary and Bavaria and Czechoslovakia. What I'm putting modern names on, but Switzerland. All of these inland nations. That's where all the power was. But as soon as they discovered the New World, all of the power went west. All the power then fell into the hands of all those Atlantic seaboard nations, which had all the navies, because they immediately sent out their navies, conquered these lands. The Spaniards conquered the land, the Portuguese conquered the land, England sent out, even France sent out. They had all these navies. They went over and conquered these lands, and these lands provided revenue, constant income of revenue to these countries on the Atlantic seaboard. It completely shifted the power away from the Pope. And you think, well, how is this happening? All this power shifting away from the Pope. All this power shifting away from the old countries. All of the old established powers. And what that did was it opened it wide up for the rest of the world to be evangelized by what we can say now is the Protestant influence. Or the Reformation influence. And if you look into history, you got to look at that. This is one of the biggest things that ever happened. In all of history, nothing shifted the balance of power more than this one thing, that they discovered a whole new world over here, and this was a rich world. This was a rich world. There were tons of gold and stuff already ready, not even had to be mined. But the Aztecs already had mines. The Incas had mines, huge mines that they were working because they would pull out this gold, and when the Spaniards got there, everybody was decorated in gold. And that's what they wanted. They wanted gold. And the reason why is they kicked that gold back. That gives gold in the hands of these kings. And then these kings have armies. And with these armies, they can impose their will upon all these things, on all these different federal... It's what brought us out of the Dark Ages, basically, is what I'm saying. All of these things brought us out of the Dark Ages. The printing press, the fall of Constantinople, the discovery of the New World. No longer do we have a weak, no central government, just the Pope himself has the power. That disappeared. That was gone. There was no way to keep all the power centralized in this Holy Roman Empire. The power then was put into the hands of these few powerful kings, like the King of England, and the King of Spain, and the King of Portugal, and the King of France. Tremendous power. It's one of the biggest events. It could have happened in history. And I look at it and I say, that was God. The Muslim conquest of Constantinople, the printing press, the discovery of the New World, all happening at the same time. And it caused a tremendous shift. And then the Reformation just goes boom. So that not only does Christianity become reformed, even Catholicism became reformed. Even in the same, even at the Counter-Reformation with the Spanish Inquisition, they're trying to get rid of all the Protestants, and they're making all these crazy dogmas and doctrines that they're anathema, they're cursed if they do this and they do that, all these things. But even this was forcing the Catholic Church to reform itself. And there were so many reformers in the Catholic Church at that time. Like, you might not have heard of Jansenists, you maybe heard of Savonarola. These were all Catholics. They were not Protestants by any means. Erasmus was no Protestant by any means. He was a Catholic. But they were reformers. They wanted the Catholic Church to reform. And all of this put all this power in this Reformation movement. And look what happened since 1450. look what happened to the world. Do you realize that before 1450, Christianity was not the largest religion in the world, that it was certainly not the most powerful. The Muslims were way more powerful, had way more advanced scientific knowledge. They were studying the stars. They're the ones that came up with Arabic numerals, the Arabic numeral system. You know how we know decimal system, which is way better than the old Roman way of counting. All the science was in the hands of the Far East and of the Muslims. And Christianity was this little podunk, Middle Ages, Dark Ages area in Europe. And all this time, Christianity was the losing back. They were losing on every hand. They were being pushed back by the Muslims, not only in Turkey and pushed back over into Armenia, and now there's Muslims all the way up into Bavaria. You know, it's an amazing advance that they've had. Well, but the Muslims had also crossed the Strait of Gibraltar, and they had gone right up the Iberian Peninsula, all the way up into France. And they had done it before, but now they had done it again after it, and the Christians were losing on every hand. You remember the Crusade? They lost. They just lost. It was a tremendous fiasco. Everywhere they were being pushed back. Christianity was not expanding all over all the world, like some people will say. It did not. It was crushed, hurt. But something happened. Click. Just you know, make your socks roll up and down when you think about it. If you look at it historically, Christianity was beaten. They were a small little group of a whole bunch of corrupt, horribly corrupt, sick system. If you read the story about how corrupt they were, I can just give you a few examples. You've heard of the Marquis de Sade? The Marquis de Sade was a Frenchman back in the 1600s, maybe early 1700s. Still part of the old Roman Catholic system before they had finally got their Reformation fixed. And of course, I don't think they're completely reformed yet. It's a horrible thing. He was a noble. And back in those days, the nobles had a whole lot of privileges that regular people didn't have. But he was a noble, so he had a title and he had an inheritance. But he was an orphan. So he was raised, his younger years, he was raised in a brothel. He was raised in a whorehouse. And so they say that he was just pampered by all these prostitutes. And they pampered this little kid that was about 10 years old. When he was 10 years old, he was sent to the abbey. And the abbot was horribly corrupt, homosexual sicko, just a really bad guy. And he had his own brothels and he had his own things. This was just how corrupt the system was. You know, they talk about what they found over there in Spain, where they had this convent of nuns on one side of the river and a convent of monks on the other side of the river. And they had tunnels dug between them. And they had big old chambers underneath there where they had thousands of skeletons of aborted babies because of the corruption that was in this system that was there. So think about Christianity from this standpoint. It's not going out and, you know, sending missionaries out to China and trying to save all the people in Africa. It didn't happen. If anybody were to look at it back in the 1400s, or in the 1200s, or the 1300s, they look at this and say, what's the weakest religion of all? It's Christianity. Buddhism grew like crazy during this time. Muslim grew like crazy during this time. But something happened. Before they got completely destroyed, before the Muslims completely ran over Europe, God did something. Just click. The printing press. The printing press caused Germany within 100 years to be the dominant power on earth. Within 100 years. Just because they had like 90% of the printing presses were in Germany the first 50, 60, 80 years, whatever. But not only that, the discovery of the New World gave so much incredible resource power to places like England and Spain, and these were all extremely, extremely devoted Christian, including Catholic. I'm including Catholic as Christian because England wasn't much better. They were Anglican. Before the Reformation, these places were as Christian as you can get. That's about the best you can say. But all of a sudden they have power. And so much power that they can just defeat all the Muslims, all over. And then they have this printing press, which just incredibly increases their knowledge. And it just expands, and there's universities placed everywhere. The balance of power worldwide, not just in Europe, but the balance of power worldwide gets shifted to England and Spain, mainly. And of course, they fought it out. And then they had this Spanish Armada, back during Queen Elizabeth, that time. I think I put that in there, 1588, to defeat the Spanish Armada. Listen, this was a huge thing. The King of Philip of Spain was going to take over the English Isles because Elizabeth had gone Protestant and he wanted to bring them back to the Catholic faith. It was actually King Henry VIII that had done that. But so he amasses an army it's like the hugest army that there is, had them all set over there in Brussels waiting to cross the English Channel, and sends this armada of 300 and some odd ships, so many tons of ships that they were going to go. And England did not have neither the army to fight them in England nor the navy to fight them on the ocean. And the Spaniards sent this armada to go up and transport this army, and the weather turned against them. Every which way they wanted to go, the wind's blowing the other way, and they returned. They had so many ships sunk during these horrible weather storms, and then when the English finally sent their navy out to fight them, all the wind was contrary to the Spanish Armada, and the English just destroyed them. That huge navy army setup was sunk in the English Channel in the North Sea. Some of them to try to escape went all the way around Ireland on the other side and said that they were still sinking out. The winds were so bad, they were sinking out. They said they were shipwrecked. So many were shipwrecked, came up on the shores in Ireland from them trying to get back to Spain by going all the way around. And the King Philip himself said this was God. God did this. I could have fought the English. He said, I just can't fight God. I didn't expect to fight God's winds, you know, that sort of thing. All of this, if you look at it, you'll see it. This was the hand of God doing something for the future, for the world. And now look at the world. Just look at the world now. What's the largest religion? Christianity is the largest religion. When in the year 1400, it wasn't even close. We're not even talking about, only Europe was Christian at all. And it was being overrun by Muslims. And what was Europe back in those days? 50 million people. Whereas China was, you know, half a billion. And of course you had India and all these. These were Buddhists. Then you had the Hindus. Then you had the Muslims, which were probably 400 million people. All of North Africa, all the way up into the Pakistan mountains, all of the Caucasus, all the way up into Russia. This was all of old Asia, what's called the Middle East, or what it's called Turkey now. But all of that area, very high population centers. They were all, none of them were Christian. These were not Christian. The Christianity was the smallest of all of them. And within 300 or 400 years, it's the largest religion.
You know, Christian? What was the cradle of Muslim? Where did Muhammad, where was he raised at? Where did he?
Medina, Saudi Arabia.
Saudi Arabia.
And they had a cult there to the moon. A bunch of idols, and he got converted away from idols. He realized the idols was what was bad. He got influenced apparently by Jews and Christians, and he turned away from idols and started his own religion, and they tried to kill him. And so he had a group of bandits that, just like David basically, and he struck out in Medina, and he fought and became a very good warrior and defeated the house of Mecca, which was trying to kill him, and took over that entire region and forced them all to change. And then he kind of like backstabbed the Jews, or the Jews tried to backstab him. And so then he went over and took over them, and went all the way over and took over Jerusalem, took over all of Saudi Arabia and all the Middle East within his lifetime, easily. And then after he died, the two factions, there were two groups that went off different directions, and they went different directions conquering. They were a religion of conquest. They weren't trying to convert you. They just made you submit. And once you've submitted, if you weren't a Christian, you had to pay. If you weren't a Muslim, you had to pay taxes. And basically, everybody just converted because, you know, if I just convert, I have to do the same things anyway. You know, you still have to, do all the same things they had to do, but you had to pay these taxes, and so everybody converted.
So is Muslimism is the religion of Muhammad, kind of like Judaism of the Israelites, right?
Well, Muhammad was the founder. He supposedly was
the
prophet.
But they didn't have like the death of the testator or, you know, like
no.
When he died, is that when it got stronger, was it?
No, he was a warrior himself. He's the one who established the religion while he was alive, and it was a religion of conquest. He was a warrior.
And is it like the same religion it was when he was living, or did it grow?
It has not only expanded, it's divided. There's a whole bunch of different Muslim groups.
Well,
the two main ones are Shia and Sunni. And the Shia went one direction, the Sunni went another direction. And so North Africa is one, and Pakistan is another. And of course now they've gotten kind of mixed in, so that they're little pockets of, but these two groups of Muslims do not like each other. They do not get along. They're always fighting. Civil war is like crazy.
Well, what was its belief back when he first started? Was it started?
They believe in one God. They do. They reject idols. They have a certain number of rituals that they have to do. It's called their daily thing. They wash themselves five times a day, and they speak always well of Muhammad. They several times a day they gotta say he's the prophet, he's the only way, whatever. And it's a very simplistic religion that does not require, it's not like philosophical, but they have gotten deep. I mean, telling you, these Muslims, they're huge universities studying the Quran. It's just like we have studying the Bible. They've got them studying the Quran. But they were big since forever. They conquered so much land within the first 100 years. Well, look, Muhammad was born in 610. And when he died, like in 675 or 680, he had already taken over the Middle East. But by 732, 680 to 730, 50 years by the time after Muhammad had died, within 50 years, they had already gone all the way up into France. They had conquered all of Spain, all of North Africa, gone all the way into Spain, taken over Portugal, taken over all of Spain, and already gone all the way up into France before Charles Martel got enough of an army together. Him and several other nobles got together and defeated, it's an amazing victory there. That was God too. that they defeated this caliphate. I forgot his name. I didn't write it down. I got it. But they defeated this one general of the Muslims. And the same thing happened on the other side in the Battle of Akroinon within 50 years of Muhammad's death. So by the time Muhammad died, within 50 years afterwards, they had taken over all of North Africa, all of the big handle of Africa, the whole top part of the continent. They'd taken over all the way to India. They'd gone all the way to India, all of Pakistan, all that, all taken over, Afghanistan, all the way up the Caucasus. Right now it's Kurdistan, and all those, it goes all the way up to the Caucasus, all the way up to Russia, and all the way up to Albania, all the way into they had just taken over and most of Europe. They had taken over most of Europe. So within 100 years, the Muslims had taken over. They were a huge religion. Of course, Buddhism at this time had already become huge, and they grew like crazy too. And Hindus, they were big in that same group. They were same region. They didn't expand. They're not evangelistic like Buddhists and like Muslims were. But the Hindus, they were huge there. All of these main religions, Buddhism, Hinduism, and Muslims, were bigger than Christianity. Way bigger, and way more powerful, had way more understanding, way more, they knew the heavens way better. If they wanted to learn, if Europeans wanted to learn something, they had to go to the centers of study in the Muslim lands or in the Buddhist lands. Like Marco Polo back in the 1200s. He had to go, and he studied, and he went all the way as far as China, and learned all these things, brought back spices, and you know, all that stuff. It was because that's where those centers of real knowledge were. But everything changed within 100 years, just night and day, turned it on its head. Now there's twice as many Christians as there are Muslims. In fact, Christianity is half the world. Half the world. And this happened within no time. Basically, a blink of an eye when we're talking about history. from the year 1500. I guess we could date it from the printing press 1450 to by the year 1900. Christianity had just. And the truth is, it's still growing. Christianity is growing faster than they say Islam is growing faster because of their birth rate right now in some places, but they haven't checked Mexico. Mexico's growing enough for all of us. The truth is, this was God's doing. If you look at this history, you got to say, wait a minute, Christianity was defeated, and things that were completely beyond our power and so coincidental, you think, how is this possible? And it completely turns everything on their head. Now the centers of learning are Christian nations. Now all the great advances, Christian nations. The Industrial Revolution, Atlantic seaboard. It was these nations that God gave the power to because of Christopher Columbus discovered a whole, he didn't know he had discovered, but discovered a whole new continent. And what that gave was, just think, like if you found, you had a backyard, you didn't realize that your backyard was really 500 acres and it was full of gold mines. That would be the difference. Or, you know, you discovered oil in your backyard. I know people who were just like us, and they discovered oil in their backyard, and all of a sudden, they're not just like us anymore. These people are filthy rich, buying up land here, buying up land there, you know, putting in swimming pools in their house. People that I used to play with, friends of mine I used to play with, were poor people just like me, discovered oil, and their whole world is different. This is exactly what happened to England, Spain, Portugal, France, Holland. God did it. He just turned the world on its head. I find it amazing. And then, of course, you get into more modern, you get into the actual Puritan movements and the Baptist movements of England, and then, of course, the Great Awakenings and the abolitionist movement, the Second Great Awakening, and the woman suffrage movements, and these movements that just move you way beyond anything any of the others had ever imagined. The freedom of religion movements, the democracy, and all that stuff. And then guess what happens? You see how it all turns back around? In 1917, Britain took over Palestine from the Ottoman Empire. The Muslims had it. Since 1099 or 1100, they overtook it, and they had it since then, but Britain got it back. After God turned everything on its head, Britain got it back in the First World War, defeating the Ottoman Empire. And nobody can even figure out what that war was about. Nobody knows what it's about. If you study the First World War and try to figure out what it's about, you know, somebody killed some Duke of Ferdinand, whatever, and so somebody attacked somebody, and everybody just, nobody even knows what it was about. Nobody knows what it gained. Nobody knows where it went. Nobody knows who won. Germany finally got defeated, and that's what caused World War II. But think about it. The truth is, these things are just a little bit awkward. These are really funny. These are. I look at it from my perspective, and I say, God did this. God was doing something because he had an own plan. And he moved Britain into North Africa early on. And then when the war erupted, they had this presence there. They attacked and moved around, and they had several important generals in the British army. A guy named Wingate or Winthrop or something amazing, but he was fascinated with what's called Christian Zionism, the idea that the Jews. He was a premillennial. He believed in, like we do, that the Jews are a nation that God still loves and that he wants them back in their land. And the Jews were talking about a homeland, but not in Israel. They were talking about a homeland in Africa or in somewhere that nobody would care, you know. And they, of course, the Christian Zionists were saying, no, it's got to be right there because the Bible prophesies it. And this guy said, we're going to go this direction. Why go over this direction where all the oil fields are? We're going to go this direction. And he took over Palestine instead. For what reason? The Ottoman Empire lost it. They weren't even trying to defend it. Britain took it over, and when the war ended, it was theirs. It belongs to the British. and the British utter the Balfour Declaration, saying, "We consider this is the nation of Britain, the nation of the United Kingdom," issues a declaration that was signed on to by Woodrow Wilson, believe it or not, who agreed with it, and said, "We have decided that this Palestine that we've taken over is going to be the homeland of the Jewish people. If you want to come, you're welcome to come." And they came by the thousands. Thousands. They just bought up all the land they could buy. This bought up the entire seaboard, the entire part of Israel that's along the ocean, belonged to the Jews within a few years. And that's when the Arabs started their trying to kill. Arabs attacked Jews and the British. And so the British changed their minds after about 15 years, issued the white papers, which says, no longer, no more immigrants, we can't take any more. And of course, then the Jews trying to bring in their family, and the British saying, you can't bring in your family. And so then the Jews start fighting the British. So you have the Arabs fighting the British, the Jews fighting the British, and the Jews and the Arabs fighting. It was a three-way war for about 10, 15 years over there in Palestine. Finally, after World War II, Britain says, we're done. We're out of here. And they turned it over to the United Nations. And the United Nations had drafted a thing saying that on this date, they carved it out, what is occupied by the Jews is going to be the Jewish homeland. And what is occupied by the Arabs is going to be the Arab homeland. And the Arabs made the mistake before that happened of attacking the Jews. And the Jews turned it around with help from Russia, no less. Turned it around and drove the Arabs back. And so that the Israel, even though they only occupied the land along the coast, they took over militarily almost the entire area of Palestine. They couldn't take over Jerusalem. They tried. They couldn't take over Jerusalem. So that one little sliver all the way up to Jerusalem is where the Muslims held. But because the United Nations already decided, there it is. So the War of Independence, Israel had 10 times as much land as they expected to have. And all of those Arabs in front of the advancing Jewish armies, they got up and left. And then they couldn't come back. They just lost all their land. That's the way we have all these Arabs in Gaza Strip and in the West Bank that are angry as they can be at the Jews because they can't go back and go to their own farms again. But the Jews can't let them back in. It's an unfixable situation that God did. Just to let you know my point of view on it. Okay, when you're dealing with history, you also have to look at the history of the important development of doctrine. Listen, I don't want to go too long. I could just talk forever. I love these. Well, I'm almost done here. I'm going to start getting into something else. I'm just going to give you an uptake then on what's important. You've got it in your papers. I didn't get to write down all my notes on the paper before we lost our printer, our thing. I'm glad I printed this much out. But there are some doctrinal issues in historical Christianity that developed. And they weren't real clear at the first. And so we can deal with the doctrine of the Bible. And this is the doctrine, not just the Bible itself, but the doctrine of the Bible, the concept of holy words and inspiration and a canon of books that are to be believed and other books that are not to be believed. It's a huge, important doctrine. If you start studying, and I'm just not going to go into it, I just don't have time. But if you start studying into it, you'll find that Christians believed not only the Old Testament books, but they believed in a group of writings by the apostles in the New Testament as early as Ignatius, which we're looking at the year 100, 120. And they have a list of the canonical believed books of the New Testament back in the year 200 called the Muratorian Fragment. They got it. It still exists. So they know that they had a list of canonical books as early, and they were a little bit different than ours. Most of ours are there, and they have a few there, and then some of ours are missing. So in that area, wherever that Muratorian Fragment was found, that area had a belief that these were the books. And of course, there was an argument up till about the year 350 And around the year 350, everybody came to an agreement on the 27 books that we have today, including the East and the West, and that was a big deal. The Greek church didn't like Revelation, and the Hebrew church didn't like Hebrews. Or it's backwards, one way or the other. One of the groups didn't like Hebrews, one of the groups didn't like Revelation. And by the year 350, both sides had accepted the other side's books. So that now, which is an amazing thing, and you can't figure out how this happened, all the Christian groups in the world have a 27-book canon of the New Testament, which is... How does that happen? That doesn't even happen among the Muslims. That doesn't even happen among the Mormons. The Mormons have two different canons. You know, one of the groups has the Pearl of Great Price, and the other group doesn't like that. And you know, they have different doctrines, different ideas, different beliefs. The Muslims have different concepts of what is official doctrine, what's not, which of the writings is true, which of the writings are not. But not Christians. You have the Armenian Church. You have the Syrian Church, you have the Coptic Church, you have the Eastern Orthodox Church, and you have the Roman Catholic Church, as well as the Celtic Rite, and all of the different groups. They all have a 27 book canon, just like ours. They all came to a perfect agreement on what constitutes the Bible, the New Testament. There's been a bunch of argument over the Old Testament, but several things that come interesting to me. The canon was clear, was made clear by a bunch of arguments. The truth is, there was almost no arguments over 21 books. 21 books, no arguments. Four Gospels, from the very beginning, they cannot find anybody who disagreed with those early on. Now, Marcion, he accepted the four Gospels, but he rejected some others. But there was almost universal agreement on 21 books. The books that they kept arguing about, besides the apocryphal ones like the Shepherd of Hermas and the Letters of Clement, well, those were not written by apostles, and everybody knew it. But you had a bunch that said they were, like the Epistle of Barnabas and what have you. And then, of course, you had the Gnostic documents, which if you've ever read them, you realize it's not difficult to determine which ones are and which ones aren't canonical. Those things are absurd. Absurd. Incredibly absurd. But anyway, the importance of the canon, that's huge. Then you have the principles of the Vulgate. I don't know. It's hard to overestimate the importance of this. Back in those days, all books were written by hand. There was no printing press. There was no digital original so that you just print out more copies. This is our mindset today. And the idea of an original autograph, before the printing press, there was no argument over original autographs. The concept that there are some original autographs somewhere that we can go to and get the authoritative, authentic truth of the beginning, that was just stupid. The whole idea of publishing from the very beginning, from all these times when they were doing it by hand, the whole idea of publishing was you had to have a standard. You couldn't... No, there was no... It was impossible to check the original. Nobody could travel... Back in those days, you just didn't travel. Nobody could travel somewhere to find the original. And nobody knew where the original was. Everything was done according to what was called a standardization technique. They got guilds. They called them guilds of publishers, where all of these copiers, they would handwrite all of them at the same time while somebody up there dictated. So you'd have 50 copies made while somebody's dictating all at the same time. And they were not looking for an original autograph. They were looking for every one of them to be the same. And so they would always constantly be comparing manuscripts, not ancient manuscripts, but current manuscripts, comparing them to their sources and to other schools, other guilds, comparing them, trying to come up with a standard. And they did. It's perfectly proven by all of the texts that we have that by the year 350 or 400, the Vulgates had emerged. You had all of these early amateur copies made all over the world. And when the publishing guilds finally, when Christianity became official and powerful, by the year 325, Council of Nice, 380 was the official religion. By that time, you had publishing guilds that were establishing the what they call the Vulgate, or the standard reading of the Bibles. And the only problem was you had two different languages, actually you had a bunch of different languages with different standards. Most of them followed one of these two big ones, though. You had the Latin standard, and you had the Greek standard. And these are called the Latin Vulgate and the Greek Vulgate. By the year 385, Jerome had made his decisions on his Vulgate, and they were standardizing these. Just what Jerome did, they did it also in the Greek side, and they come up with these Vulgates. And Jerome, a big decision on his part, was to reject the Septuagint. The Septuagint was the Greek copy of the Old Testament, and it was extremely corrupt. It had been changed in incredible ways, and everybody knows it to this day. They'll use it to correct the Bible when they want to, but the truth is, everybody knows it's an extremely corrupt, messed up, not just by Christians, but by Jews long before Christians. And there were like six or seven Old Testaments in Greek. Origen had what he called the Hexapla, which were six different common versions in his day, the year 250. And so, you know, everybody having their... It was just a mess. Jerome says, if not trustworthy, I'm going with the Hebrew. So Jerome made the Latin Vulgate, hooked it up with the Hebrew Old Testament, and made his translation into Latin. It wasn't just him that did the translating, but more than him. But anyway, that was a huge step, because that established the Masoretic text as the received Old Testament in the West. And then, of course, you have the Greek church, which kept the Greek Old Testament, and there's still a problem with that. But then what becomes important is these Vulgates became almost perfectly aligned. So to the fact that you can take 100 different manuscripts and put them all together, and they're almost identical, which is true perfection of that kind of printing. If you can do that, it's amazing. And they had these things memorized. After they copied them enough times, they've got them memorized. They could just read a New Testament manuscript and say, that's not correct right there. So it became so standardized, and they call it the Vulgates, that only purposeful, intentional alterations would happen. And that did happen in the Latin side. So the important thing about this is when the printing press came about, this is back in 1450, and all of these Greek Vulgates came over, the entire Christendom started clamoring. Catholic, Protestant, Reformation, doesn't matter. They all wanted a combined Bible for both languages. They wanted one universal text. And they wanted it pulled out of both Vulgates. They didn't want to trash the Latin Vulgate. They realized the Greek Vulgate in the New Testament was better. And so they took the Greek Vulgate, and then they took some corrections from the Latin Vulgate. Things that were missing in the Greek, they would supply them from the Latin. And they joined these together and made what at that time was the obvious objective. They made what's called the Textus Receptus. And the Textus Receptus is more than just a text. It's a principle. It's a principle that we're taking the Vulgates. We're not looking for ancient. In fact, one of the principal architects of the Textus Receptus is a guy named Beza, you know, over there in Calvin's Geneva. And Beza, he had an ancient manuscript called D. It's called the Codex Cantabriginis, or whatever it is. It's like the year 400. It's an ancient one. But he rejected it. He had it on his desk. Even though it was the most ancient one anybody knew about, he rejected it because it had funny readings. And it's true, it was before the standardizations happened. All these ancient manuscripts that were copied before the standardizations would be, they'd have different funny readings. And they didn't want funny readings, they wanted standard readings. And so that's where the Textus Receptus came from. And all the way up till about the year 1885, the Textus Receptus was what the Bible was. And of course, we still stick with it. We hang on to the King James Bible because we're not interested in new fangled ideas about original autographs. The original autographs were irrelevant within a generation. 20 years after they were written, the original autographs were irrelevant. There were so many copies, so many places. Only a few people would have access to anything original. And there's a lot of good evidence that over there in the Greek side, over there in what we call, it was Asia Minor, what we call Turkey now. And those areas where all the originals were sent, written and sent, and that's where they had them, that's where the Greek Vulgate came from. They were there, that's where they standardized, they had access to them for the first couple hundred years. And so we assume that that's as accurate as you can be. Anyway, we have good reasons, not superstitious reasons for following the King James. We have good, reasonable, and historically valid reasons for sticking with the standard Vulgate and then the combination, which is called the Textus Receptus. And look, I'm getting into more. Y'all got any questions?
I did, but I forgot them now.
I'm sorry.
I wrote them down.
Well, one thing going back to Muhammad, while he was living, is that the same religion that modern day is, or did it evolve?
It's developed. It has evolved.
What he originally come up with, you know, getting away from idols and all that, I mean, was there any, there wasn't anything Christian about it. It was more or less, you know, they had a deity that they followed. And
not
they,
Christian.
Yeah.
Now, Catholics will say it came out of Catholicism. But the truth is, it's a mixture of Jewish beliefs, and these are medieval Jewish beliefs, the diaspora. These are Jews that were separated from their origins. Remember, they were kicked out of, their whole religion had changed. And this was when Judaism was in flux. It was before the Talmud, before they had become standardized themselves. So he had Jewish ideas, and he had Byzantine Christian ideas, which is very similar to Catholic ideas. So there were these influences, but he had his own set of religions, being an Arabian. He had his own set of religions. He belonged to a certain cult. I forget what it's called, Kabbalah or something. It's some kind of a cult back in those days that worshipped the moon.
Is that what they have at the Arabs have in their flag?
They do have the moon and the star.
Yeah.
That has to do with the new moons. Anyway, they have a lunar calendar still, just like the Jews do. I'm not really sure what the moon and the star has to do with their flag.
Well, was he a power freak, or I mean, like a Hitler or anything like that, where people or he was just had these beliefs?
He was a warrior. This guy was a good general, and he was treated wrong. He wasn't with the right clan or with the right group, whatever. He was treated wrong. He was exiled, accused falsely. I'm not sure exactly what, but he was forced to leave, and to survive, he had to be a guerrilla. And as a guerrilla warrior, he gathered some people, just like David did, and they were bandits on the road. And when they sent armies out to destroy these bandits that were on the road, he whipped them. He beat them, and they couldn't beat him. And finally, he sacked Mecca, took them over. And as a warrior, took them over and abolished idolatry. He just, because he'd been influenced by Jews and Christians, he'd been influenced by them. He believed in one only God, not all this multiple gods, and he was against idolatry. He believed idols were wicked. And he wiped out all the idols, and they were all forced to agree with him. He started all these armies, and he went out conquering. And when the Jews, they betrayed him. He killed them and went over and took over, went all the way, I think he went all the way to Jerusalem. They lost it after that. The Byzantine Empire was strong for quite a while. But sooner or later, within 300 years, they had pushed the Byzantines back. They took over Jerusalem in 1099. During the Crusades had gone and taken back Jerusalem. But then the Muslims went back and took Jerusalem back and pushed them all the way back, and finally Constantinople fell.
Now, I read somewhere, you know, like the Dark Ages and stuff, you know, that people lived only a short period of time. There was a lot of famine and stuff like that.
There was a century. One century. I think it was the 14th century. 1300 to 1400. They had so much famine, so much plague, the Black Death. They say all the way from India all the way to Iceland, like a third of the population died off in that one century. It was bad. But no, it wasn't always that way. They had some bright spots in the Dark Ages, and they had some pretty bright minds in the Dark Ages. And of course, the Muslim Empire didn't go through the Dark Ages. They were a center of learning and a lot of power. In fact, Muslims to this day think of those as their glory days. They don't think of themselves as a backward people. Muslims to this day think of themselves as, we're in a bad shape right now, but that's only because Christianity eclipsed them. And that's only because of what God did in the New World. We would not have eclipsed them. We would not have had the power to. But God gave a few little nations, Christian nations on the Atlantic seaboard of Europe, more power than they could imagine. They had more armies and power, and they could just keep on funding them and funding them and funding them. They took over the whole world. The whole world was there. You know what they say, that the sun never sets on the British Empire? Because the British Empire took over the entire world. They had India, they had China, they had all the land, they had Australia, they had all of North America. They had, the British Empire was everywhere. And before that, and if you really want to do it, the Spanish Empire was everywhere. They took over all the Pacific and all of South America. But England owned all of Africa for a while. This is all God's doing. It wasn't. And Britain did something with the freedom that they had, the power that they had from all of their rich trade that they had from the Americas and all that. It was an amazing amount. But what they did was they developed iron smelting, and they developed railroads and a steam engine, and they built an industrial complex on that little island that rivaled the power, the capabilities of the rest of the world combined. They had probably 90% of the railroads in the world on that little island for probably 100 years. And then, of course, America took all of that knowledge. Then when they discovered the Bessemer process to make steel, everybody else in the world was left out. We had everything. We had everything. All the steam engines, internal combustion, everything came out of the Industrial Revolution. All the advances in medicine and all that. Good old Puritan on a little island somewhere that God says, we're going to give you a blessing here. And just...
And the King James Bible.
And the King James Bible. It's God's doing. Just in my mind, there's no doubt this was God's doing, and he did it with a view of what we're looking at now on the earth. The position Christianity is and on the earth, and the position that Israel has right now in the earth, this was God's doing. He let it go till about the year 1400, and then said, all right, now we're going to change things. And just aimed around it. And that's exactly where he wanted it to be.
You know, like certain times in history when God pulled back for hundreds of years, like when the time between, the prophets and when the Lord was born, you know, it's like pulled back and everything chaotic, and then all of a sudden comes back in, and then the Lord, he comes that down as a man, and then it goes for several years, and boom.
When you get into the doctrinal side of it, and you see where these doctrines started coming up and sprouting, and how these doctrines change nations. England, as a nation, completely transformed by this Puritan and separatist factions. Completely transformed, which eventually transformed New England. And we're living that today. Just transformed by doctrinal knowledge. Just, they get an idea, and they were right. And even when they were wrong, the doctrines... It's amazing how doctrines just have changed people. You know what breakfast cereals are? Breakfast cereals...
Hardcore.
They are a doctrinal decision made by Seventh-day Adventists. They did not believe in eating See, back in the old days, they ate eggs and chicken and bacon, and that's what they ate for breakfast. That was their breakfast, everybody. And they did not believe in that.
Well, they ate cereal on Saturday.
The Seventh-day Adventists did not believe in eating meat, especially not pork. And so they start this, and that was up there in the bread belt. They start this wheat stuff, cream of wheat.
Oatmeal?
Not even oatmeal.
Malt-o-meal?
What's the stuff you eat?
Shredded wheat?
Shredded wheat. They start this shredded wheat craze, and then all this stuff where they put milk in with all these grains, the cereal grains, which are the grasses. And now the whole world is fed by grasses. I mean, Iowa, the Midwest Belt, all that up there. You know Kellogg? You know what Kellogg, General Mills? These are all Seventh-day Adventists.
Really?
Seventh-day Adventists, and they've changed the world because they say you don't have to eat bacon. You don't have to eat these. This is not what's important. That's not what's good for you. And they push this, and it caught on. Milk cereals caught on, and it's all over the world now. Well, I won't touch the stuff. No, you know, it's just amazing.
Right. So it's not, it was a religious thing.
It was a religious thing, and it transformed the world.
Wow. And it's not that there's anything bad with eating cereal, but it's kind of from a religious conviction thing.
Seventh-day Adventist, if no less. This was a weird cult back in those days, you know.
Wow.
Of course, the Seventh-day Adventists, they have that same list of all these dissenting groups from the main religions, and they insisted that they all met on Saturday. Of course, and some of them did back in those days, but not all of them, of course. Just like the Baptists say they all were Baptists. Of course, they weren't all Baptists.
Yeah.
Anyway.